This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On a Friday, here's where we are. We've got the week that was. We've got big oil bringing big problems. And we got for-profit colleges having some big problems of their own. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 14th of March today, and we're going to get right to it. Figure out what happened this week, economy-wise, and why it happened. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is what we call it. For that, we've got Neela Richardson with us. She is from Bloomberg Government. Also, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. They are both in our cozy, cozy Washington Bureau. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Neela, let me start with you and the economic goings-on in Washington this week. There's apparently a deal now on long-term unemployment benefits in the Senate to restore those. They were dropped back in December. The president is making some moves on overtime. Is it possible that Washington has decided to get the way out of the way of the economy, that is?
You know what? At least with this emergency funding, I think there is some positivity. I say hooray for Washington for getting this done. And on overtime pay, that's a whole different issue. It adds to President Obama's phone and pen strategy of trying to get as much done on inequality and raising incomes that he can without using Congress.
Sudeep, is he getting traction on the income inequality thing that he's been trying to do? I mean, he's been raising the minimum wage for some new federal contractors and now the overtime thing?
He certainly is getting traction on this. You're seeing this not only in the United States, but globally. And this week, the International Monetary Fund was the latest to sound the alarm about income inequality around the world. So it is really a defining issue of our time. With the overtime rule in particular, the president is highlighting how so many millions of workers have come off the bottom rung of the ladder, but still aren't making enough to get by. These aren't the least skilled workers. These are the people who are actually doing better than others. And so they should be rising up more quickly. But if the White House decided it didn't have enough businesses annoyed by regulations and annoyed by rules, then it certainly found a way to add a few more to the list.
Yeah, Neela, there's going to be some pushback, right, on this overtime rule for sure?
Sure, there's going to be pushback, and it does add to some uncertainty, as Sudeep suggests. Look, there's going to be changes to the minimum wage, both at the federal, state, and local levels. There's pressure for that. There's changes to what is a full-time work week now because of Obamacare. Yep. And now here's a new set of regulations. So definitely pushback.
Does any of this, Sudeep, make you believe that the economy is going to get better, or is this a nuts-and-bolts solution, right? It's going to make a difference in people's lives, but not in the aggregate.
These are ways to move the pieces around as we're going through a moderate growth approach to the economy. Nobody is really counting on big changes in the economy from Washington. There might be, assuming the rest of the world cooperates, there might be some stronger growth by the end of the year in the United States. But this is really just to tread water and tread water in a different way than we've been doing it before.
Yeah. Speaking of the rest of the world, Neela, there is a referendum in Crimea this weekend. The markets have been a little jittery, but not honestly as bad as you'd think, given what's been going on. Why is the market just watching this and saying, okay, fine?
You know, the market, I think, feels pretty confident that the U.S. is isolated enough from the events in Russia and in the Ukraine.
Yeah, and we should
that
be clear.
That may change over the weekend.
Right. We should be clear. Well, it may change over the weekend. But we should be clear, you know, Russia's not a huge export market for us. Certainly Crimea is not either. So that's right. What's going on there.
Right. Right. And so the worst case scenario is a stepping up of sanctions if Russia becomes too aggressive. And again, that may not have the trigger for U.S. markets that would cause a lot of chaos.
Sudeep, what do you think?
Well, it's impossible for anyone in markets to plan for an actual war in a region,
yeah.
but to plan for an economic war, to discuss sanctions and all of the possibilities that would come out of this. If this happens to Crimea, if this happens to Ukraine, there are three or four steps down the line that have to occur before we see this. It is interesting to see that a place like Russia has gone in a quarter century from a total pariah for investors to be the promised land and back to pariah in such a short period of time in this this scale of the economy, that you're going to get to a point where people will say, okay, well, maybe I just want to avoid that part of the region, and it cuts off yet another part of the global economy from the prospects of integration.
Well, it's going to be an interesting weekend over there. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is in Washington. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government, also, I should say, in Washington. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, good weekend.
All right, take it easy. On Wall Street today, there was a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and then some more of this. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we talked about the markets a little bit, Sudeep, Neela, and I did, and the reasons that things have been a little bit wobbly this week. Here's another one for you, a veritable raft of weak data out of China. Industrial output, fixed asset investment, retail sales, you name it, all of them were down the first 2 months of the year, very much what analysts had not been expecting. We asked our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, what's going on over there, and he reminded us we've seen all this before.
For 3 years in a row, there's been weak economic data out of China at the beginning of the year. For 3 years in a row, the best economic forecasters failed to predict how weak the numbers would be.
This is the third time in a row this has happened, so why are we still being surprised by it?
Andrew Batson is a lead China analyst at Gavikelt Economics in Beijing. He says part of the reason is it's seasonal, end of the Christmas season, and China shuts down for Chinese New Year. But there's a bigger, more important reason.
The momentum of the Chinese economy is much slower now than it used to be. The second thing that's going on, I think, is that essentially the Chinese corporate sector is in a lot more financial stress than it used to be, right? So debt levels have shot up.
Some blame China's government for tightening up credit. But Ann Stevenson Yang, director at J Capital Research, thinks it's simpler than that. She says China's economy is on life support.
When you put more credit in, there's a heartbeat, and when you don't put more credit in, there isn't. So all of those numbers are trending negative, and the question is anybody willing to pump the machine again?
So far, it's not clear whether China's central bank will loosen up credit. Economists say China needs to stop setting GDP targets. They put pressure on local governments to meet them by spending more. And one more thing, says Stevenson Yang, China needs to accept it's having a recession and move on. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Turning once again to the power of the president's pen, as Neela was talking about up in the wrap, the Obama administration has some new rules for for-profit colleges and vocational programs. They are known as the gainful employment rules because career colleges are supposed to prepare their students for, yes, everybody say it now, gainful employment. In this case, that means the job one gets after graduation will pay enough to pay down the loans one takes to get to graduation. This isn't the first time the White House has tried to crack down on the billion-dollar for-profit college business, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR.
The first gainful employment rules were tossed out almost 2 years ago by a federal judge. Now the U.S. Department of Education is back with an 841-page second act.
For a federal agency with a tree on its logo, printing it would probably be destroying like orchards.
Ben Miller worked on the first round of regulations at the Education Department. He's now a policy analyst at the New America Foundation. Miller says one reason the new version is so long.
I think you're seeing a lot of attempts to make this as legally bulletproof as possible.
Career programs that don't measure up would risk losing access to a huge source of revenue, the $150 billion pot of federal financial aid. That's if more than 30% of their former students default on their loans within a certain period, or if graduates must spend more than 8% of their earnings on student loan payments, or more than 20% of their discretionary income. For-profit colleges are already gearing up for another fight.
What we have is this ideological declaration of war.
Steve Gunderson leads the American Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. He wouldn't say whether the group plans to sue over the new rules, as it did last time, but he says debt and income aren't the right ways to measure student success.
Gainful employment ought to be that you get employment in the field of study which you're pursuing.
Education officials estimate about 16% of programs would fail under the new guidelines, but they'd have a chance to clean up. Analyst Trace Urdin with Wells Fargo Securities says colleges are likely to shrink or close expensive programs like art and design that don't always lead to well-paid work. And they'll be more selective.
You're going to be very careful to only admit students that you know are going to be strong job applicants at the back end. And in some respects, they're going to be sort of doing the job interview as a precondition of enrollment.
All sides will have a chance to weigh in during a 60-day comment period. And the lobbying starts now. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The thing that's holding it together is really this idea about everyone out for himself.
It won't surprise you to know there is money on the line. Big oil is where we're going. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.25% today, 43 points, closed at 16,065. The NASDAQ reversed 0.33%, that is 15 points, finished at 4,245. The S&P 500 took off 0.25%, ended things 5 points lower at 1,841. Tensions in Ukraine kind of weighed on the week. That and China, as Rob Schmitz was talking about. The Dow off 2.3% Monday through Friday. The NASDAQ off 2.1%. The S&P 500 down 2% on the nose. On Wall Street, Goldman Sachs backed up 0.8%. Today, Citigroup forfeited 0.9%. Teen retailer Aeropostale got pounded today after missing earnings expectations. Its shares were down 20%, 20%. Might seem a long time ago now, but small investors were piling into the bull market that was back in February. That boosted shares in discount broker E-Trade by nearly 1% today. General Motors also found the upside after yesterday's drubbing. The automaker regained 0.8%. Bonds fell, but just barely. The yield on the 10-year T-note inched up to 2.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases industrial production data for February. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And you attend a parade and drink green beer. You wonder, what did people do to celebrate St. Patrick's Day during Prohibition? You don't think about this for too long. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are approximately 13,588 school districts in this country. So says the latest data from the Department of Education. A group of parents in East Baton Rouge, Louisiana, are trying to add to that number, though. They are so fed up with the public schools there that they are trying to create their own city, St. George, it would be called, and with it, their own school district. East Baton Rouge has some of the poorest performing schools in Louisiana, but the movement to incorporate in St. George has divided people over race, class, and resources. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noel King reports.
The parents on either side of this argument don't agree on much, except this.
My kids are only going to be little once. They're only going to get one education. And at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for your kids.
Your first priority is to your own children.
You know, at the end of the day, most everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants their children to have better.
Better in East Baton Rouge Parish often means sending your kid to a pricey private school. The state ranks nearly half of all public schools in the parish D or F. So at the forefront of this current fight over the public schools, a lot of middle-class families. Like the ones at this evening meeting at Woodlawn Baptist Church. A group of St. George supporters are talking about ways to collect enough signatures to put the incorporation to a ballot initiative. Dustin Yates works for the fire department, and he's in the audience. He's sending his kid to private school, and he just got the bill for first grade.
Just the base tuition's about $4,300. You add another I'd say $1,200 a year for aftercare, so now we're at $5,500. Then you add in your extra miscellaneous fees that accrue throughout the period of the year. So we're somewhere probably in the neighborhood of spending $6,500 to $7,000 just for one child.
For a guy who calls himself as middle class as they get, it's too much. He wants the option of public schools. Yates says he's speaking from personal experience about the school system. He taught and coached football for a year in the district.
I witnessed quite a bit of violence. I always kind of felt safe because, you know, I have a physical presence and I'm just not going to be intimidated by a 17-year-old kid. But my heart did go out to certain teachers that did feel bound by the lack of discipline regulations in that school system.
Here's where it gets sensitive. Because there's a perception about the kids at the center of a lot of the discipline problems in the East Baton Rouge public schools. What you hear from parents all over the parish is that these are kids who aren't getting a lot of support at home. Some say that's coded language for kids from poor, predominantly black areas of Baton Rouge. So Yates and the other parents at this meeting want to make something clear.
Just because I was raised in the southern part of the United States doesn't mean that I'm a racist because I want something better for the middle class. It just means I want something better for my family. And it doesn't, color does not interject itself into my thought process whatsoever.
But demographically, the area that would become St. George is both wealthier and whiter than the city of Baton Rouge. LSU economist Jim Richardson was commissioned by a local chamber of commerce to look at what might happen if St. George incorporates.
The median income is $90,000 in the proposed city of St. George. It's $57,000 in the city of Baton Rouge. You know, again, major differences.
More than a $30,000 difference. That would mean less spending per pupil for the kids in Baton Rouge and more spending per pupil in St. George. And it could threaten a part of the public school system that is thriving, Magnet and Gifted and Talented programs. If the school system as a whole loses money in students, it'll be harder to fund the Magnet programs. Belinda Davis is with One Community, One School District, a local advocacy group that opposes the St. George movement. Her three boys are in Magnet programs.
Even if residents in the Southeast are not being motivated by a desire to get poor black children out of their schools, that is exactly what is going to happen.
The narrative that race is a factor is something both sides are aware of. Clay Young owns a local marketing company.
So much here in this part of the world is not about race, but so much is.
He lives in the area that would become St. George, but he's not taking a side on the issue. He says he's upper middle class, but not rich. He's African American. His two kids go to private school. Young believes any kid can learn.
But children who come out of households where there is not structure, don't know structure, and they tend to go into environments and cause chaos. And so you've got parents who are both white and black who are nervous about putting their kids in environments where there's going to be chaos. Now, people don't really want to say that because it's not PC and you sound like a racist or you sound like an elitist.
Young knows he's lucky to have financial options. His fear is that the tug of war over St. George could spur everyone with the means or mobility to leave. And the only kids left will be the ones whose parents have no other choice. In Baton Rouge, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Back in 2007, oil was discovered off the Ghanaian coast, off the coast of West Africa. A lot of oil, which meant a lot of money, which meant a lot of people got interested in a big, big hurry. What happened next to the Ghanaians involved and to the Texas oil men who made the discovery is the subject of a documentary film called Big Men, which starts rolling out in select cities, as they say, this coming weekend. Rachel Boynton produced it, wrote it, and directed it as well. Rachel, welcome to the program. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First of all, I don't mind telling you, I dug this film. It was gripping in a way that, honestly, documentaries usually aren't. Part of which was the access you had. You were talking to oil company guys and the Ghanaian government and Nigerian rebels. How did you get into all these places?
Well, it took a lot of work. You know, oil companies are not exactly generally inviting independent documentary filmmakers to come and film for long periods of time with open access. So that was probably the biggest hurdle.
And not the Nigerian rebels?
No. Well, I mean, that was hard, too, but it was hard for different reasons, because I wasn't just trying to walk in the door. I was trying to spend some time there, you know, and film for a while.
Right. We should probably set the scene, the cast of characters. Kosmos Energy, an oil company out of Texas, goes to Ghana, basically, and tries to negotiate an oil deal for some leases, for some drilling rights, right?
Right. Kosmos drilled its very first well as a company in 2007. It was a well off the coast of Ghana. And with that very first well as a company, they discovered this massive new field in a country that had never had oil. So it was this crazy important moment for the company and also for the country as a whole.
And then you take us to the Niger Delta in Nigeria, which is infamous, really, for the problems that oil has brought to that country and the tragedy, really, of having resources.
Yeah. When you're telling a story about new oil in a country, a lot of people are going to want to know, well, what happens to the country? Do they benefit from that resource? And I knew from the get-go that I wasn't going to be able to answer the question, what are things going to be like for Ghana in the future? Because I wasn't willing to spend 20 years making the film. So I very purposefully filmed in Nigeria as well, because that's a place where you can really see how things have played out over time.
I want to get to the title of this movie, Big Men. What is it? Where did that come from? What does it mean?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time running around Nigeria before I started shooting, and it was just me. I met militants, and I met oil guys, and I met ministers and presidents, and I was really fascinated by how freely people would talk about wanting to be big. I mean, it's kind of an amazing phrase, right? I want to be big. I want to be a big man. And the fact that they were so open about it, I found kind of fascinating. They were giving voice to something that I see all the time in America, but that people don't really talk about quite so freely.
There were a lot of things that amazed me about this movie. One of them, you know, you sort of know, right? The degree to which oil has corrupted things in Niger and the Niger River Delta, and how the locals who live there sabotage the oil pipelines to get their slice of the profits, how economies spring up around oil byproducts there. They're selling this like explosive fake gasoline or whatever it is. I mean, it's bananas the way this thing trickles through the economy.
That scene, you're referring to a scene about the pipeline fires.
Yeah.
This is the one thing in the film that I used a fixer for. Somebody helped me.
A local. You had a local.
Yeah,
who
I had a local person who helped me out. So anyway, I went out to these fires, and we had to wade through a river of sludge because the oil was everywhere. And I happened to be wearing my one good pair of jeans that day. So I ended up going behind a bush. Luckily, my guide was wearing two pairs of underpants. And one of them was this pair of tidy whities, and the other one was a pair of boxer shorts. So he gives me his boxer shorts, and we both go through this river of sludge in his underwear. And so we film that. And then we go back to the village, and we filmed this amazing interview with two of the guys who set that fire.
Oh, these two guys,
yeah.
This was crazy.
I realized over the course of the interview that they live in this town where they've set these fires. And you got to understand, this town has been destroyed by these fires. There's smoke everywhere. I mean, it's absolutely toxic to live there. The land is destroyed. And I say to these guys, you know, you live here. Did it ever occur to you that you might be shooting yourselves in the foot by setting these fires? And one of them says, yeah, you know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, but, you know, we don't have any opportunities, we don't have any jobs, so that's why we do what we do. And the other guy kind of smiles slyly and he says, I don't really think I'm shooting myself in the foot because, you know, if I shot myself in the foot and somebody paid me money for it and I didn't die, that's all right with me.
There's a Rashomon-like quality to this story, right? Because you got the oil in the middle of it, and then you've got the Ghanaian government and the Ghanaian guy who brokered the deal for Kosmos Energy. You've got the Americans in Kosmos Energy. You've got Nigerians and how they feel about oil. Eventually, at the end of the movie, not to give anything away, but you've got the American stock market and how it feels about Ghanaian oil.
Yeah, it's like a series of circles, this
movie.
I mean, and how they all interconnect. The thing that's holding it together is really this idea about everyone out for himself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's an idea that is connecting everybody in the film and dividing everybody in the film. And so it needs to work both on an intellectual level as a story about this major resource, but also as a human story about people and what's happening to them in their lives.
It's called Big Men. Rachel Boynton thought of it, directed it, produced it, did pretty much everything out there, crawling through the sludge. Rachel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for yours.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which science completely validates conventional wisdom and, I should add, my parenting techniques. I speak here, of course, about the five-second rule, the idea that if you drop food on the floor, you can still eat it, provided you pick it up fast enough. There is actually a study out of Birmingham, England on this topic. They tested toast, pasta, biscuit, which I guess is a British thing, ham, dried fruit, and a sticky dessert, both on smooth tiles being dropped there and on carpeting for anywhere from 3 to 30 seconds. All right, anyway, the upshot, carpets leave less bacteria on your food than tiles do. Also, 5 seconds is basically okay. And also, by the way, they found 87% of people said they would eat food that had fallen on the floor. All right, we got to go. That's it. I'm a good parent. I swear I am. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 0.25%, 43 points. The NASDAQ reversed about 0.3%, 15 points. The S&P 500 down about 0.25%, ended the day 5 points lower. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. It is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Have a good weekend. Not tomorrow, Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.